Good afternoon, good morning, good evening. Welcome to another All About Windows Phone Insight podcast. I'm Ewan Spence, and it has been a busy week. Imagine you driving down the motorway in fifth gear, and you suddenly try to get down to fourth, and you go into first instead and do a handbrake turn and go off in another direction. It's that sort of spin-inducing chaos that Microsoft has brought, not just to the world of Windows Phone, but to the world of Windows and consumer electronics this week. We're going to talk about that, the impact it has on Windows phones, the partners, what we can expect to see in the next 6 to 12 months, who's been left behind, who's been pushed forward, and joining me to take that tumultuous task, first of all, we have Rafe Blanford. Rafe sat through the entire presentation from the Developer Summit. Congratulations.
Yes, I did, and I was up late writing it all up. But hello, everybody. We're going to be talking about that later in the podcast.
We also have David Gilson, who's been taking copious notes, keeping an eye on a website reaction around the world to the news, who also joins us with a fresh pot of coffee.
Yes, hello, Ewan. I think I need a heavy dose of that caffeine, please.
And Steve Litchfield is lying down in a darkened room somewhere because somebody mentioned Scion 3 times in a row and it appeared in a mirror like in a really bad horror novel. I'm Ewan Spence. As always, you can leave your comments back on the website, allaboutwindowsphone.com. You can get in touch with us through Twitter, Facebook, all the usual places. And let's get started now. But before we go into the contents of our very special show, we saw blossoming of Nokia's strategy last week, almost as a little get ready. What's that opening bit of a menu you have before the first course, Rafe? Is that the aperitif?
The appetizers, Ewan.
The appetizers, yes. Nokia gave us an appetizer, but not a thesaurus, unfortunately. Rafe, Nokia's strategy is taking a little bit of a shift, and it's a little bit clearer now, isn't it?
It is. I mean, this actually came bundled with a whole lot of other Nokia news, some of it was actually pretty bleak. Basically, Nokia is having, I think, a tougher transition than it was expecting in terms of moving from Symbian to Windows Phone. It announced 10,000 job losses, it announced that the financial outlook for Q2 and looking ahead a little bit has been revised downwards, so we can expect more losses from them when they're announcing their results in kind of mid-July. But they also talked a little bit about how they were going to refine their strategy. And that, with regard to Windows Phone, was basically they're going to go Windows Phone faster than they were before. There's also going to be a Series 40 component to it. If you want to hear more about that, you might want to listen to our All About Symbian podcast, where we touch on kind of some of those in more detail. Meltemi, which was a Linux-based platform for low-cost devices, we think is going away. Series 40 is going to come in, and then Windows Phone, as I say, is going to go down into lower price tiers faster than was previously expected. And Nokia said that Microsoft had done some engineering efforts, and Nokia themselves had done some engineering efforts, and had given them some vision going forward that meant we could expect to see devices costing less than the Nokia 610 before too long. As I say, that was faster, really, than was previously anticipated. And so Windows Phone really getting down into those mid-tier price points. The other side to this was that Nokia said they were going to increase the kind of investment on creating differentiation, or consumer experience, as they termed it. In other words, they're going to make things that are unique about their Lumia devices. And that might be anything from, you know, material science. There's kind of investments they can do there. You know, think of the next generation of their polycarbonate cases, for example, nanotech materials. And there's a lot more going on there, but it can also be on the software side. You know, they'll be doing more applications, more experiences. And probably the best example of that is something they also announced, which was the acquisition of some of the assets of Scalado, which is a imaging company, or rather software engineering company, that concentrates on imaging. They're actually responsible for Nokia Creative Studio and a whole lot of low-level software. And they've got some real expertise about doing clever things with the processing of JPEGs and their manipulation right down in the sort of low levels when you're creating them and capturing them on the camera. And actually, we saw some announcements come this week from Nokia about some new exclusive applications on the way, one of which was camera extras, which is going to bring in some functionality like self-timer, panorama mode, action mode, which is kind of burst photography, and smart group shot, which is probably the pick of the bunch in terms of cleverness. Allows you to take a series of photos of a group of people and then pick out the facial expressions and then choose which facial expression you want from the series of photos you've taken to create the perfect group shot. We're going to talk more about those when they're actually available in the marketplace. You've got a story up on the site if you want to read about them. So, you know, to summarize that strategy, it was really about doubling down on Windows Phone because it's going to go into lower cost devices more quickly, and they want to increase the investment to kind of differentiate their devices. As I say, it was coupled with a whole load of bleak news about spending cuts and job losses. We've got an article on the site about that as well, so go and read it if you want more information.
Hey, Rafe, very briefly, we've always talked about in the All About sites that Nokia was going to go through a lot of pain to make the transition from Symbian to Windows Phone. Putting aside any sort of emotional, did they make the right decision or not, this sort of pain, is this about what we expected, or is this hurting more than Nokia have planned for?
I think it's probably hurting more than they were planning for, but it's not clear whether that's because Lumia sales aren't ramping up as quickly as they expected, as much it is, you know, Symbian sales going down and the rise of Android. So I'm not sure it's something they could necessarily anticipate, because it's about the kind of competitive dynamics. I think they would have liked to sell more Lumia devices, and they did actually talk about the issues they were having breaking into the sales channel, which they were talking about being dominated by iOS and Android, which if you've been into a high street shop in the UK, you can see for yourselves. And they sort of also announced as kind of part of their strategy that they would be refining their, what's referred to as their go-to-markets approach. So they'd be concentrating on a couple of key markets, investing more money. That was places like the US, China, the UK, and some other European and Asian countries. And they would be looking to do big deals with retail partners and operators, trying to mirror the success, as they put it, that they'd had with the operators, T-Mobile and AT&T in the US, rather than kind of the broader approach that they tried in some other markets. And I think that's probably code word for the UK, where they've kind of gone, you know, for a broad spread approach and maybe not had the sales success that they were expecting. But it's tricky here. What is the reasonable level of expectation for Lumia sales? You know, it was always going to be difficult building up from scratch, going through this transition, especially with a generation of devices that I think, in all fairness, you have to say, you know, they got to the market very quickly, but there were some missing holes, both in the hardware and the software platform. As we'll see in a minute, that's some of that's been addressed. But they did get them out. So I actually don't think, you know, sales of that many more devices would have made that big a difference in terms of what they'd have had to do in terms of warning about profits, or indeed in sort of cutting back personnel. I mean, you say, well, say they'd sell double the number. If you look at the margins going on in device and services, which is the division that makes the smartphones, I'm not sure it made all that much of a difference. Obviously, selling more is always good, but the kind of strategy changes, this transition they're going through, probably would have been just as rough. But I think it goes without saying that obviously it's going to be very important for them to continue to ramp up sales, especially when the next generation of Windows Phone devices, the next generation of Lumia devices comes out.
Lots of strategy pieces are falling into place. We'll see how Nokia's do as we go out through the months and years. Keep an eye on the website on that. Another strategy that's been taking a long time coming is Microsoft's unification strategy, bringing everything. So it's essentially one place when you're a coder or a developer. Everything looks the same. Of course, Windows 8 is a key part of that. We saw another element this week, and I'm going to call this bit the main course. Not the main course, the first course before we hit the main course. David was keeping a close eye on this one out. Microsoft's Surface technology. Now, David, this isn't strictly Windows Phone, but as we're about to learn in the podcast, it is playing a strong part in the ecosystem.
It is, and you could argue that it's a case of a rising tide floats all boats. Microsoft actually managed to pull an Apple here. No one knew what they were going to announce. They mysteriously announced a press event with very short notice for all the US journalists to get the flights across to Hollywood. And no one quite knew what it was. I mean, we all expected it was possibly something like this, but it could have been an Xbox thing as well. But it wasn't. It was a Windows 8 announcement. And Microsoft aren't saying who are producing this, but it's Microsoft are back in the tablet market. No, they're not copying Apple. They were there already. They've announced two devices which all come under the name of Surface. They've managed to co-opt their existing brand name for these like big bar coffee table size touch devices, and they've made these 10.6-inch tablets called Surface. The first one to be released is going to be running Windows RT, which does not stand for retweet. It is Microsoft's ARM implementation of Windows 8. And then people are going to have to wait 90 days later for the Pro version, which is actually going to be running an Ivy Bridge processor and running full Windows 8 Professional. As you may or may not know, Windows RT includes Microsoft Office, so it'd be set for productivity. The RT version will have solid-state storage in 32 and 64 gigabyte sizes, and the Ivy Bridge version will have 64 and 128 gigabyte sizes. One of the things that people liked about this is that the flip case that protects the screen is actually a keyboard, and there are two different types of keyboard. There is like a membrane version and a mechanical clicky keyboard as well. And the tablets have a 5-pin proprietary port that these keyboards connect to, but then they're also secured in place by magnets. I think this is interesting because as Rafe said earlier on before we started recording, it's reinforcing the message of Metro everywhere. And at the moment, Windows Phone sales may be held back because people either love or love the tiled interface of Metro, and they either get it and love it, or they're kind of close mind to it. The more Microsoft get Metro in front of people on the desktop, the more normalized and popularized Metro may be. However, something we were talking about before is that the debate of the effectiveness of Metro on the desktop has yet to be won, really, because when you're on the desktop, you're doing something. You're not just staring at the screen. So how useful is Metro going to be? I'm not sure. I kind of like having it because I'm running Windows 8 release preview now on my laptop. So I'm going to hand over to Rafe now. What do you think about the Surface and its effect on Windows Phone?
I think in terms of the effect on Windows Phone, you really nailed it. It's about the kind of Metro everywhere experience. And the thing that struck me most about it was kind of the instant feedback, reading along the lines in Twitter, and was, you know, really positive from geeks sort of saying, I'd like one. Now, of course, there are caveats. We don't actually know all that much about these devices. You know, it's all going to be down to what's it like to use in the real world, you know, in terms of performance and battery life. But suddenly the Windows 8 message, I think, became a lot clearer. And, you know, the idea of having a common experience in terms of, it's not just user interface, because actually it's not the same user interface, but it's the same design language and it's the same kind of experiences on phone, on tablet, on desktop, and then also actually on Xbox under your TV. You know, the idea of this unification strategy, as Ewan referred to it as, I think becomes a lot clearer. And, you know, with tablets, obviously the big, you know, elephant in the room is the iPad. And I think Microsoft needed to do something to address that, and by producing their own tablet, they've done that. Now, it'll be interesting to see what strategy they take with this. You know, is it something they're going to push out everywhere and try to sell as many as possible, or are they going to use it as leverage to kind of get their existing hardware partners to, you know, step up their game and do something similar? You know, for me, actually, I think Surface is probably positioned more as almost a professional device against the iPad. You know, the idea of the inclusion of the Office suite, for example, and this keyboard, you know, makes it a much more of a, you know, a creation device than a consumption device, which is, I think, where the iPad is at its strongest. I mean, it is going to be up against, you know, a well-established ecosystem and all of that. But I think when you start to see the way that it will all play together in the Microsoft strategy, particularly, we're going to talk about this in a minute with regard to the Windows Phone Summit, you know, there's a common shared core between all of these Microsoft platforms that has an implication for developers and service providers, not just the kind of the common user consumer experience I was talking about. I think it's really interesting. And just from the point of view that I saw a Surface and a tablet and I thought, ooh, I'd like one of those, which I can't say I've really said about any Android tablet. You know, I'm a happy iPad user. I think it's a really great device. But I can sort of see that Microsoft is getting back into that game. And that kind of relevance, I think, is really important in projecting a perception of this, you know, this complete experience if Microsoft is to find success outside the, you know, its traditional desktop homeland, if you like.
I have to say, I looked at this and was kind of almost surprised, but I was thinking, yeah, I'm interested in having one of these. However, I have yet to be convinced about the idea of having a tablet as a complementary device. I'm happy with the combination of smartphone and laptop. I don't really feel like I need anything else. So I would be interested in having one of these on the proviso of how well does it perform as a primary device. And really, the solid-state storage and the screen are going to be very limiting factors in that, which make it unlikely. But Ewan, what did you think about this? Do you want one of these?
You know, I'm looking at that and thinking, that's really nice and shiny. The geekerati in me is just like, yeah, gimme, practically, it's an interesting one. There are a couple of things that I need a heavy lifting computer for. Audio and video editing are the obvious ones. But at the same time, most of my stuff is writing, in which case I just need a good keyboard, and web browsing, looking at a big screen. And I find it intriguing that almost every single PR shot of the Surface had that keyboard attached. It was as if Microsoft, you know, didn't want to go straight up and do a head-to-head straight in the face of the iPad. It reminds me of Sugar Ray Robinson, who would just kind of bounce around the boxing ring and just pretend to do a little punch and bounce around and wear his opponent down, and then at the end come in and go bang with something that was completely unexpected. So they're pitching this as a very, very light laptop. In fact, I think what Microsoft's pitch here is it's saying its hardware partners know, like this, and basically goading them to step up. I think the big surprise for me, and this also has relevancy in Windows Phone, is just how tied into enterprise this device is, the Surface. How easy it will be to integrate into an office space, something that RIM tried to do with the Playbook but haven't. There's going to be a lot of IT managers going, do I want all the hassle of these standalone iPads, or I've got this Surface thing now, which fits in with the exact same security stuff. It fits in with the same procedures that we've already got on here. You know, I think Surface's Sugar Ray Robinson punch is actually in the enterprise support. Rafe?
Yeah, I agree with you on the keyboard. I think that was a very clever bit of presentation, kind of, you know, because everyone focused on that as a bit of innovation. And don't get me wrong, I think it's really clever, you know, integrating a keyboard into a cover. You know, it's kind of the next step up from the magnetic covers that Apple did with the iPad 2. But I think you've also drawn on something important there. These aren't just tablets. These are actually somewhat ultrabooks, I would say. And they're kind of in that space between tablets and laptops. In fact, they're almost both. And so it does offer interesting, you know, value for money. And I would say, actually, this would be the ideal companion. Instead of having a laptop, have one of these, and then you might have your mobile phone, and then you might still have a desktop computer, you know, back at your office. And, you know, the point about these kind of four different types of devices, I guess, you know, phone, tablet, laptop, desktop, is you'll mix and match which pattern is right for you. But more than that, you know, remember there's two of those. There's Windows RT version. That's, I would say, a more direct competitor with the iPad. You know, it's running on ARM. It'll have great battery life and performance. It's a bit thinner. And it will be restricted in the sense it's not going to run the classic Windows so thoroughly. And, you know, there's still information to come out about how exactly all of that will work. But the almost the more interesting one is the Windows 8 Pro version, which is basically a full Windows 8 computer, but it's also a tablet. And so that will have capabilities that I don't think any other tablet out there really has, not in that form factor. And yes, it is a bit thicker, and yes, it has grills to get the heat out and all of that because it's running an Intel chipset inside. But relatively speaking, you're still talking about a very thin and relatively light bit of equipment. I mean, looking at the stats, comparing it to the iPad, the Windows RT one's actually slightly lighter and slightly thinner. The Windows 8 Pro one is, I would say, quite a bit significantly thicker. I think it approaches sort of an extra 20 millimeters or so. But it's not that vast a difference, and so it is still very much a portable device. And so it'd be interesting to see how these do, because I think it's Microsoft's way of really reinforcing the message around Windows 8 and the One Metro experience.
And now on to the main course, which of course has hits of all the courses that have happened before it. The Windows Phone Summit. Rafe, have I got that name right?
You have got that name right, yes.
Which is unusual because we had Microsoft Windows Surface ART for ARM chip, Ivy Bridge and everything. Finally, we had something that was quite short and it just caught us all out by surprise. Yes, the announcement of the broad strokes of what is going to be happening with Windows Phone 8. Microsoft surprisingly gave us 8 points of discussion. That must have been a long, ooh, this might be a good idea when they were putting together all the PowerPoints. Lots of stuff to talk about. Rafe, how about we bounce over the quick highlights and then talk about the implications of all of that first, shall we?
Yeah, well, the first highlight is we now know it's going to be called Windows Phone 8 officially. Previously, that name hadn't actually been disclosed. And I think probably the big news in terms of the platform engineering is that it's going to share a common core with Windows 8 itself. What does that actually mean? That's things like the kernel, device drivers, networking, file system, media and security model and elements are all going to be shared with kind of desktop and tablet and everything else, Windows 8. And, you know, that's a bit of a game changer. You know, you're moving from basically a Windows CE base to a Windows NT kernel base. And that means there's much closer alignment between the two platforms, and it has implications for device creation in terms of, you know, you've got those already existing device drivers out there, that existing knowledge base, and of course the kind of the maturity of that kernel, of course, as well as any benefits that then also has on things like developer and common languages, and we'll touch on some of the hardware stuff, but trust me, you know, that kind of really changes the game for Windows Phone, in that suddenly it's, you know, not just a stepsister of desktop Windows, it's actually basically running the same stuff at the low levels as desktop Windows.
I found it very interesting that they always talked about sharing code rather than write ones run anywhere, right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, although these components are shared, they will be optimized for the mobile device experience. And that's partly because it's, you know, running on a different set of hardware and a different set of requirements. So although, you know, you might think it's exactly the same, in reality, it's not going to be exactly the same, but it will be coming out of kind of the same code base, if you will. And that actually is a good point, time to point out that kind of the same thing applies to developers. I mean, there will be a common base in terms of some of the C++ components, as well as thinking about the runtimes, because you know, one of the things that Windows Phone 8 introduces is support for native C and C++ code. But at the same time, it's not just a question of, you know, run your XE on Windows Phone. There is still going to be this kind of managed environment in terms of app distribution. I mean, that's kind of part of the security model. And developers will have to do some work when porting the applications, but it's really going to be around the differences that actually in the hardware, i.e., you know, you're dealing with a different screen size physically, which means a different touch resolution. So you are going to have to do UI differently to match. So yes, this idea of, you know, write once, run anywhere, that's not what this is about. This is about the common underlying fundamentals. And as I say, it does have an impact on development, and it has an impact on consumers in that it will enable a lot more sharing of stuff. But I think in some ways the biggest impact will be on the device creators.
And just to have a comment on the high level layer of this, but the write once run with small modifications in different places. I mean, it's indicative of where the ecosystem is going. As I mentioned, I'm running the release preview of Windows 8, and I will look through the Metro store to see for any apps that I'm looking for. And actually, things are very thin on the ground there, but I'm looking there and thinking, ah, I wish that app that I have on my Lumia was available on here. I want a Google Reader application. I want this and that. And it's like, before long, I think, we will be getting these cross-posted applications.
Yes, I think that's one of the things we'll probably see as the biggest obvious advantage to consumers of this common core. And we will talk more about the developer stuff later on in the podcast. But yes, you know, the implication is, and you know, a demo was run at this Windows Phone Summit of an application, I think it's Wordit, something like that, that was written originally for Windows Phone. It was ported over to Windows 8 in short order, and they actually added in some extra functionality as well. And that's something we will see an awful lot more of. So I suppose that's probably the big takeaway from the Common Core as far as consumers are concerned. You know, this kind of level of app portability and crossover is likely to dramatically increase. And so the fact they're both called Windows goes beyond, you know, just a branding now. There is actually really a reality to that message, I feel.
And it comes back to what I mentioned earlier in the Surface. Let's assume that you are a medium-sized enterprise. You're looking to re-kit out all your technology, but you've got a bespoke ordering system maybe for making three-piece suits that your salesmen take out onto the road. In theory, you should be able to then have the majority of your code shared between your desktop computers running Windows 8, the tablets that are out there with the fancy showman on Surface, the guys that are all guys and gals out there on the sales team who are all running Windows Phone. That application suddenly becomes much easier to be portable across everything. So when you have somebody like maybe running an Android handset, and you've got guys out there with iPads and someone that's sitting with strange Linux computers and everything, you know, all of a sudden the enterprise guys are going, well, look, we can buy all of this. You know, we can get your phones, we can get your tablets, we can get your desktops, we can get your laptops, and it's all still within the sort of IT security management system. And we've even got a bit of help there with the Windows Phone 8 Business Hub. Rafe, you know, we've always been talking about building blocks and everything becoming cohesive. It's like Microsoft pulled the blanket away. Nobody went, ooh.
Yeah, that's right. I think particularly for this kind of enterprise support, if you will, you know, you mentioned there the Windows Phone Hub. That's basically a way that companies will be able to provision LOB or line of business applications, but it goes a lot further than that. Because of this Common Core, it's actually using the same security model as desktop Windows. So that means you get things like device encryption, BitLocker support, also, you know, secure boot support, and all of that for enterprises where security is a big deal. And that can be financial institutions or legal stuff and all kinds of other industries as well, which are basically on BlackBerrys because they need it from a security point of view. Will be able to use Windows Phone 8. We're still actually waiting for some of the exact details of this, but I'm pretty sure that this is going to be certifiable as a trusted computing platform and all those government legal requirements for many of those industries. So I think, you know, Windows Phone 8, in some way, the biggest one it's taking a pot shot at is RIM. Of course, it's also competing with the other platforms. And it's probably worth mentioning also, we're also going to get improved device management. So you were talking about how enterprises can slot this into their existing infrastructure. And this means things like the mobile devices will be managed in the same way, using the same tools as their current desktop computers and laptops. And although Microsoft didn't reveal too much in the way of detail here, that means things like improved policy management. So enterprises will be able to specify exactly what devices can and can't do. And they'll then be able to, you know, deploy that down to devices, also remotely deploy applications. So, you know, Windows Phone was very business light in this kind of the 7 and the 7.5 version. With 8, it's basically Microsoft is using all the maturity that comes. I think a lot of this is enabled really through the Common Core that I was talking about, but obviously it also needs to come out in features. And it was interesting to see this was one of the things that Microsoft did push heavily at the Windows Phone Summit, was this idea of, you know, good for business, because there's plenty of other stuff they haven't talked about. You know, it was kind of an announcement that was focused partly about getting partners on board and making people aware of the stuff where they're going to need their cooperation partners to make it really work. But I guess we should talk about some of the other features and new things that were talked about that may be of more direct interest to consumers as well.
Indeed, yes. Take the first point that Microsoft came out with, multi-core support. We're now told that Windows Phone 8 will support up to 64 cores. Yes! I want to see the battery life on a 64-core phone.
I think I should probably point out in the interests of reality that the first phones are almost certainly going to be dual-core based.
Aww.
And I think we may get up to quad-core, you know, sometime in 2013. But don't get too excited about 64 cores.
Can I give Steve a 64-core phone with a sealed battery and just watch his face explode, sir?
And of course, we should say that this is actually a result of the fact it's running on the NT kernel, which is optimized for multi-core. And actually, when we talk about multi-core, it's important to appreciate that you really do need to have the software optimized. And it's at a whole bunch of levels. The kernel is probably the most important, but as you go up the software stack, it's also important because you need to have applications being able to run in separate threads, you know, be able to split the load between two processors. And a lot of the magic for that really does happen at the low level in the kernel. And the Windows NT kernel that Windows Phone 8 will be using, I think, is very mature in that sense. So I think it will probably end up giving Microsoft a competitive advantage over, you know, other platforms, because it will be more efficient in terms of power consumption, but also in the way it's utilizing those cores. So it'll be really interesting to see whether there's a real impact on performance and battery life in the real world from this particular, you know, hardware specification, if you like.
Yeah, it also means that Microsoft Windows Phone 8 can take part in the spec wars that Android are so delightfully pushing. Screen resolutions, 800 by 480, which we currently have, stays. We also have 720p at 1280 by 720, and the slightly awkward that everybody standardizes on it anyway because they need a little bit of extra space for the buttons at 1280 by 768. Essentially, the big, huge screens that you can get on other handsets, and you'll be able to pop them on your phone as well. You know, I do get the feeling, David, that that means that the Samsung Galaxy 3 hardware platform will now be completely and utterly supported by Windows Phone, so Samsung just needs to change over the disk imaging software.
Absolutely. I think that's a very good idea.
We also have micro SD support being added in. Rafe, I'm guessing that because we're switching to the NT kernel, this has changed to the filing system, which means micro SD support is easier to implement than the sort of all-in-one hodgepodge data suite we had on Windows Phone 7?
Yes, that seems likely. I mean, we haven't got the technical details on this, but Microsoft did explicitly mention that you'd be able to take it out of the device and use it to transfer stuff to the PC. So I think we can probably assume there'll be USB mass storage support, at least for accessing stuff on the micro SD card. We'll get more on that later on. But kind of that's really good news for those who want to use Windows Phone 8 devices standalone. On the screen resolutions, it's worth noting that because they're kind of maintaining that aspect ratio, existing applications won't have to be modified. They'll automatically be scaled up by the system, although, of course, developers will be encouraged to update their apps to take advantage of the new resolution in terms of things like graphic assets. So it's kind of interesting that we didn't see any new screen resolutions outside of the kind of standard aspect ratio. Well, it's 15 to 9 and 16 to 9, but essentially one aspect ratio. It'll be interesting to see whether we can get any innovation in the form factors. You know, it will be hard to do a kind of BlackBerry QWERTY-like device or an E6-like device with that particular screen resolution. But of course, there may be more to come on that, and we may get an update in due course, either later on in the life cycle of Windows Phone 8 or even, you know, before it launches. But yes, those three hardware points are kind of the big ones. And there are a few more hardware things. I mean, I think we should talk about NFC support, for example. That's going to be much the same as it is everywhere else, you know, tap to share, tap to pair with things, tap to get information. But in some ways, I think the interesting thing about NFC is the kind of the software, the new hub that they paired it with, Ewan.
Yes, the NFC, and specifically the mobile wallet. Obviously, again, they're providing a long lead time. The financial sector is going to need a fair bit of time to get au fait with this. But, you know, Rafe, can I dream for a second? Is that okay?
Yeah, I think you're allowed to do that.
The crystal hat on. Obviously, they talked about, you know, Chase Bank in America, and you'd expect something like Visa Paywave to go on there, or on Barclay Card system and everything as well. But let's imagine if that mobile wallet also held PayPal, which is, I think, a fair guess. That taps into a huge amount of pay system. We've already seen it taps into in-app purchasing. When you make an in-app purchase, you'll be taken into the mobile wallet application, and then you'll be able to use your Chase or your Visa or your PayPal to make the in-app payment. I wonder what would happen to the ecosystem if Facebook credits were added into mobile wallet as well. I'll flag up here that I am entirely speculating, and we have no inside knowledge on this, but Facebook credits are starting to make an appearance in the real world in a couple of places. It wouldn't surprise me to see a Starbucks show coming up later as well. And Microsoft and Facebook do have good relations with each other. I wonder if there's a lot more to be seen in that mobile wallet than we saw on stage. David?
I think possibly, but the Facebook credits I think no, because I think Facebook credits are actually going away. I think Facebook have realised that people want to use their own currencies and not a made-up currency, so I don't think we're going to see that at all. Riff?
What, you mean like the euro?
I think with Wallet, one of the things that's quite interesting is Microsoft was very heavily pushing the idea that it was open to third parties, and it's kind of one of the reasons this got detailed in more detail than pretty much anything else in the Windows 8, Phone 8 preview. So you know, they were talking about how apps can integrate with it. You know, there's kind of two functionalities within Wallet. You can store, you know, credit cards, loyalty cards, membership cards information. You can enter some of that stuff yourself, but you can also have apps that integrate it with that effectively enter the information for you, but then also give you access to additional experiences. And so, you know, a bank could create an application that ties in with the wallet, you know, has an entry there. When you tap on it, the wallet will open it up, the application. But there was also a kind of voucher experience as well. This was kind of the second bit of the wallet hub, and vouchers can come from any number of sources, again third-party applications, but also web searches, can be forwarded by text messages and NFC and other kinds of means in particular. And that those, so it's kind of wallet as the two things you have in your wallet, you know, your payment cards and your membership cards, plus the, you know, stuff you might clip out of a newspaper or other vouchers that you might keep with you. And Microsoft pointed out it was kind of combining the two things that Apple and Google have done, and they go, well, we've got both. I thought that was maybe a slightly cheeky jab, but it's an interesting point. You know, this is kind of a new battleground, and it's all around mobile payments and who controls that. But, you know, Microsoft are taking a pretty hands-off approach in the sense they're going to allow anyone to integrate with it. It's going to be open to third parties, and anyone will be able to use it. It's not just tied to their own partners. And the NFC connection to this is obviously about enabling easy mobile payments. The thing that really caught my eye here was they're going to put the secure element for NFC, which is obviously necessary for doing payments, on the SIM card. You know, when you're implementing secure NFC, that's actually a number of ways you can do it. You can put the secure bit on the NFC chipset itself, you can put it on a micro SD card, or you can put it on the SIM card, and you link the two using something called Simple Wire Protocol. And it's basically the approach that operators like the most, for understandable reasons. They control the SIM card, they control the customer relationship. And so it may be what is needed to get some operator buy-in. And, you know, when they're talking about this, Microsoft announced that Orange or France Telecom would be kind of the lead partner or the lead operating partner for this. And we kind of got the hint of that when the Nokia Lumia 610 NFC variant was announced, and Orange was going to be the first one with that. We'll see more operator partners in time. Microsoft were pretty cautious about that. They're saying, yes, more in Europe in due course. And so it's suggesting that they might be able to sort something out in America for 2013. But NFC is kind of that element that I think will really make the wallet go from being not a curiosity, but kind of an interesting thing, something that would then get regularly used. And it's kind of, there's, I think, still a lot of long lead time on this. So I'm a bit skeptical about, you know, it's suddenly appearing, but yes, it's a move in the right direction.
Okay, speaking of smooth links, Rafe, can you go from mobile wallet to Nokia Money to Nokia Maps and back again to Windows Phone 8 in 17 seconds?
Okay, yes, mobile wallet is basically the next version of Nokia Money. It's no surprise to learn that Nokia is probably the one that, you know, heavily pushed this wallet technology. They've got quite a bit of experience there. But they've also got a lot of experience in maps, and that's the other component of Windows Phone 8 that we heard about.
2 seconds to spare.
Excellent. And Microsoft referred to this as basically Nokia mapping technology being integrated into Windows Phone 8. This is essentially the data, the mapping, and some of the navigation bits are going to become part of the platform. Now, there weren't all that many details on how all of this is going to work, but Nokia did announce that Nokia Drive, in its 3.0 version, which is actually a new version, it's going to be released later in the summer, will be available to all Windows Phone devices. So I think we can take it as read that Nokia Maps and kind of the lower level mapping bits will also be integrated. That means improved map quality and also available in more countries and more complete data. And that's coming from Nokia's purchase of Navtech. It's actually what Nokia refers to as the Nokia Wear platform. It's also traffic updates, live traffic information, and turn-by-turn navigation instructions in 60-plus countries. Mapping coverage is sort of around 160-plus countries. And it also brings offline maps. So it's going to kind of build in Nokia mapping technology right into the platform. The branding isn't quite clear yet, but I imagine that this is going to replace Bing Maps in the sense that, you know, it won't be a Microsoft intermediate platform. It will be a Nokia platform. It may still get branded Bing Maps in some cases, but the interesting thing with the Nokia Drive announcement, you know, Nokia were quite explicit that it will be available. So the question is, are companies like Samsung, HTC and Huawei going to say, okay, mapping is one thing in the core, you know, because, okay, they could probably put up with a Nokia logo sitting in the map corner, but a Nokia-branded application, i.e. Nokia Drive on their devices, we'll have to wait and see on that one.
There's lots of waiting and seeing, and speaking of seeing, because I could do the occasional link as well, probably the last big jump that we had in there was the changes to the start screen. Can I just a sad lament for the disappearance of what we have in the start screen just now, which is the little gutter on the right-hand side where the arrow is.
It's a leftover from Zoom. Good riddance.
I know it is. I know, but you know, somebody actually pointed out another cute effect I'd never seen before. It's like if you scroll your live tiles all the way down to the bottom, the arrow does a little bounce to remind you that there's more applications on the right. And then it twists around as you go. Just a little tiny UI touch that I'd never consciously noticed before.
Oh,
and that's
that
gone.
Sweet.
It's gone. It's bye-bye to that. But what we do have is we have a new start menu in Windows Phone 8, which allows for another size of tile, which is essentially a smaller tile. So you get four tiny tiles into one space of the normal tile, and then you can go for the landscape tile as well. These will be resizable, assuming that the application allows it, by the users. Essentially, it appears to be a grid of 4x4 wide. So you can have two average tiles, four small tiles, or one landscape tile. More activity, obviously. This matches in with all the tiles that we're seeing throughout Surface and Windows 8. And the start screen is really, people are finally getting to grips with it, but I'm wondering if we're losing a little bit of the zen and moving more towards the widget-based because everybody's going, oh, we can get more widgets on Android.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair comment. I mean, my first reaction when I saw some of the screenshots is, it's starting to get quite messy, but then I think the point here is really it's going to be about consumer choice. You don't have to use the small tiles, but if you want to get more into the same screen real estate, you can. I think the kind of interesting thing is, of course, you can choose what the priority is on each of those tiles. So for some people, they'll put their messaging front and central, and you know the tile actually has a different experience depending on the size it is. So for example, messaging is actually a good example. When it's at the small or the medium size, it will basically display an icon plus how many new messages there are. At the large size, it will actually display a scrolling list of your new emails. Or messages, depending on which one we're talking about. And that different experience actually applies to all tiles. There's going to be a whole new set of APIs, so it's going to be possible to make the live tiles more live, if you will, you know, the new experiences. So I think living up to their name better, it is kind of the logical progression from where they are now. And yes, in one sense, it's moving more in the widget direction. But I do actually really like this idea of keeping the standard of a grid of tiles, but actually giving people the choice to kind of prioritize them themselves, you know, so effectively you'll be able to put some applications front and center or some services front and center, but it'll be very much up to you. And the way it was actually implemented, I mean, basically you know tap on a tile as you do now to move it about, and there's an extra option to resize it as well as move it. I think it's pretty neatly done. And you look at the home screens that are available elsewhere, I think it's pretty clear that Windows Phone has, you know, the most flexible experience. A lot is going to depend on third-party developers to take up the kind of the challenge here and provide different experience for these different tile sizes, as well as taking advantage of any new APIs that may come out. But it was a pretty visually compelling demo, and I think it got a lot of oohs and ahs, and I think it was quite understandable why.
Yeah, you and I have to say, I think I'll miss the gutter as well. I looked at the screenshots of these, and I realised with the screenshots, they needed to demonstrate what these quarter-sized tiles could do, and but I just couldn't help feeling that they really overdid them, and it really looked like, oh heck, we've gone back to icons. But the whole thing of Windows Phone was that where you've got these tiles, there's less fiddling to make the home screen, start screen, look how you want it to look. And now look at all these elaborate things. You've got a 2x2 tile in the middle with 1x1 tiles all around it. That's going to take a while to set up. But I think with these quadrant-sized tiles, it's certainly going to be a case of less is more, because I mean, if you just got a few, say if you got the music and video tile and then put a few podcasts, little podcasts next to it, that's a good idea. I think when you get these, don't overdo them, because it is going to look very messy. But it is good to have the choice. I do concede that.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a kind of a power user one. You know, people want to fit more onto the same screen size. And personally, I can see myself sticking with the larger size icons, and then maybe just along the top having, you know, the phone, the messaging, the email one, which mainly I have to admit I just use as shortcuts. And then some things, you know, I'll make a bit bigger. But I think on the whole, actually, it's a pretty good evolution of the start screen. And it's interesting, this is getting a lot of attention because it's one of the relatively few consumer experiences that Microsoft directly showcased and did a demo of.
Yeah, and I just as we said, it's done from the Zune. I've just picked up the Zune again. And, you know, you only had one size of tile, which was album-sized. You know, there was a bigger one to show the currently playing one. But, you know, at that point, the gutter there, David, was actually a very small representation of the next menu. The gutter was wider and had more text content. And when you switched from side to side, you could see the other gutter very small in the background. So, you know, it is evolution and moving on here. Personally, for me, I think I'm going to stick with the big tiles, but maybe in place of the music icon, I'll put three very small album covers and a short link into the music application. It does come with a choice. And I wrote an article about this. It's going to give people more chance to fiddle with their phone, and that's actually a good thing in that first 30 seconds. They can make things big and small and tiny and little and so on as well. And that fiddling might be very important. Now, yeah.
I think, Ewan, we should also point out that I think the tile size is actually almost a distraction from the fact you can do more on the tiles themselves. And this was demonstrated in the Windows Phone Summit by the Nokia Drive thing, which actually had a different icon at the different sizes, but also kind of live updating information about traffic and a kind of a mini map that was live to where you were at that particular time. So to me, actually, the interesting thing is, as I said before, the live tiles are more live, and probably try not to get bogged down just in the size issue.
So we have all of those elements, and we have more still to go as well. The other big news, Microsoft actually labeled this one up as their second point after the multi-cores and screen rights and hardware changes, was Internet Explorer 10 would be coming onto the platform as well. Not a pocket version, not a cut-down version. As far as I can tell, Rafe, this is everything that's good about IE10, the security, the trust, the rendering, the new engines and everything, being brought onto the smartphone handset, yes?
Yes, again, it's about the common core and what IE10 on Windows Phone will share with the desktop. It's the same browser rendering engine, and that means improvements in HTML5 support, improvements in JavaScript. Microsoft were talking about them being four times faster. I showed a graphic benchmark of JavaScript of Windows Phone with IE10 being faster than iOS 6 and Android 4 running on the Galaxy S3. You always take those with a pinch of salt, but IE10 is, I think, pretty widely acknowledged as being much better in terms of standards, compliance and security than any of Microsoft's previous browsers. You alluded to security there, the smart screen stuff, which is anti-phishing, anti-malicious websites. You'll, you know, get a warning if you click on, you know, a nasty link, so that's all good stuff in there as well. I suspect there's probably a little bit more to come on IE10, but it's also going to be kind of used in a browser control component for allowing HTML5 development on the platform. So kind of, again, that's adding to the developer story a little bit.
David, you've been using IE10 in the pre-mixed format over on Windows 8. What is it like as a browser? What's the rendering like? Is it up there with the likes of Chrome and Firefox?
The rendering experience is fine, although I have not used it that much on the Windows 8 release preview because the user interface is on the desktop is very immature. It's actually, I would say, it's less mature than on Windows Phone 7. So to me, it's just impractical to use on a day-to-day basis, so I have switched back to using Chrome in desktop mode.
And Rafe, I mean, how much difference is there between IE10 that will be in Windows 8 and IE10 that will be in Windows Phone just for the end user and the consumer?
Well, I mean, obviously the user interface is going to be different. you know, you can probably expect it to be much like Internet Explorer is on Windows Phone 7.5 now. I'm not sure people notice the difference until they start using sites that, as I say, are, you know, performance heavy, or, you know, HTML5, JavaScript, latest techniques. But it's really about having a bang up to date browser core on the mobile platform, and, you know, sharing that commonality between, you know, the desktop and mobile is only, can only be a good thing, because it will benefit from the development that's going on for the desktop. And I suspect that might well even end up applying to updates in the future, you know, rather than having to redo things from scratch. So, you know, I actually think this is a pretty big deal, and it sort of gets to the point where, you know, the mobile browsing experience on Windows Phone will be top notch, and it will be good, as good, if not better, than you can find anywhere else on, you know, mobile devices.
I mean, like many things, this is one of those areas where we really need to get our hands on it and try it out in the real world with a SIM card, bouncing around in towns and actually seeing how it goes.
Absolutely. I mean, we're all talking about this stuff from a series of announcements. We haven't had any hands on. No one has really had anything in depth on this. And I'm sure there's still going to be people out there going, boo, hiss, Internet Explorer. You know, I see that, you know, big E icon on my phone and just, you know, want to spit blood because they remember IE 5.5 and IE 6 and all of that. But I think it's fair to say it is a completely different browser now, completely different technology. And in terms of the browsing experience, it should be first class.
David, how is that spitting blood getting on?
Well, I think on one hand, Microsoft are kind of missing a trick at the moment, because for the current situation with Windows Phone 7.5, there's actually more integration with Chrome than there is with Desktop Internet Explorer, thanks to a third-party app called Krink. There's no synchronization at all, so there's no incentive to use Internet Explorer on a desktop and have a cohesive experience on your phone as well. Although on the Windows 8 release preview, it does say that it can synchronize your desktop bookmarks with your Live account. So I would guess, and I underline and embolden and italicize the word guess, that we will see a later announcement, Windows Phone 8, that bookmarks will synchronize by your Live account, and at which point using Internet Explorer 10 becomes much more compelling, because you can pick up where you left off on your desktop and go away and look at stuff on your phone.
Yeah, and that cohesiveness, I mean, imagine you can do that with a game, with a Word document, with an email, all of that all starts to tie in and starts to be joining in through both, as you have the sort of cloud stuff and you have the first party applications and the third party developers as well. I'm sure are going to have great fun. I'm watching the gamers out there be thinking, we can get the Havok engine finally on here. There's been some big announcements in terms of backends for developers, but I suppose the biggest one, Rafe, is native code will be allowed to run on Windows Phone 8, and that is a biggie.
That is an absolutely huge one. This is something probably been the biggest single complaint, I would say, from developers about the Windows Phone platform. You know, you're not just going to be limited to Silverlight and XNet. In fact, XNet is essentially going away for gaming, and you're going to be able to run native code. And that ties into what I was saying earlier about the common core and some shared components. And that applies to third-party developers as well. You know, they can create common components that they might use on both Windows 8 and Windows Phone, and indeed on other platforms. You know, it makes the portability of code much easier to Windows Phone 8, and that has, I think, big implications, especially for games. You made reference to game experience, and yes, it is about the middleware gaming engines. It's not just Havok, it's FMod as well, and a couple of others they've already committed to coming across, and I suspect we'll see more joining them. So it really does make Windows Phone kind of a first-class gaming platform. And I think with the other hardware changing around multi-cores and all of that, you're going to see some pretty impressive games running on Windows Phone. And so that gap that I think does exist at the moment, but particularly with iOS, will start going away, because, you know, developers are already used to porting games between platforms. They haven't really been able to do it to Windows Phone effectively because of this absence of native code support. I should also say native code support has a big deal for apps as well. You know, there are obviously some performance stuff around this, but also shared libraries. And if you're particularly a company that's kind of got a set of libraries that they port between different applications, different platforms, that's really important. While we're on this kind of subject of developer and native code, it's interesting to note that Microsoft's actually going to be doing something called Compile in the Cloud. So they're going to take the the machine code when it's submitted to the Windows Phone Marketplace. They're actually going to go away and compile it into machine code, which should improve app performance. And that's actually going to apply both to new apps, but also to old apps, i.e. Windows Phone 7.5 apps. So that may well solve the kind of the second or two pause that people are used to seeing when you're starting up applications. That should be diminished with this particular change. And I'd say, yes, native code support, I think we'll be hearing a lot more about that, and it's going to make a lot of very happy developers.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of tricks you can do. For example, if you look at something like WizTiles Pro that we have on Windows Phone 7 at the moment, it can't launch certain applications because it's siloed. It doesn't have that nature. With native code support, it would be able to do that.
Theoretically, it's worth stressing here.
We're guessing here.
There's actually still an app security model going on here, and there were references made to application data sharing and the ability to launch things. But actually, Microsoft didn't talk very much about the APIs. We'll mention a few that they did mention just in the last bit of this podcast. But just because there's native code support, it doesn't actually mean suddenly you can do everything on the phone, because there will still be a security model. What it does mean is you can bring across your own components and run them effectively in a sandbox, which is, you know, things like gaming engines, for example. And I think actually that's where it'll apply most. You still need APIs to get into platform functionality. And while it's pretty obvious that there are more platform APIs coming, we don't actually know the full details of that yet. So before we get too excited about, you know, you being able to do everything, it is still very much a managed environment.
Yes, you can do more of the everything that you wanted to do, but you can't do the everything that you thought you were going to do. We only want you to do the everything that's more of the everything that you could have done before now with the next version rather than the last version, even though the code for everything on the last version will run on the everything of this version, right?
Yes, Sir Humphrey.
Indeed, and we haven't got to the front end of the civil service, multitasking, or all those other APIs that we mentioned, Rafe, have we?
That's right. There weren't many APIs mentioned, but three that I think are worth touching on. Speech APIs. That means you'll be able to not only open an application with your voice, but actually do stuff with it. There was a demo of Audible where it was used to search for content, skip to the next chapter, pause and play back. And so that'll be an interesting one to see how much that gets integrated. I think the more interesting ones are the VoIP integration. Again, this is something that it will be available to everybody. Microsoft demoed it or talked about it using Skype, and it's running in the background, so that problem will go away for Skype and these kind of applications, you know, so you can leave it running. You don't have to have the application open in order to make or receive a Skype call, but it'll also be integrated with the phone. So as far as the consumer is concerned, there'll be no difference between incoming and outgoing VoIP calls as there would be to a cellular call. It'll be interesting to see the operator reaction to that, but actually it's much the same system that you actually have on the Symbian platform at the moment. So that level of integration is really great, and I think it's really nice to see that Microsoft has taken the open approach and that anyone will be able to do this, not just Skype. So, you know, Nimbuzz or any of the other VoIP operators could come along and do their own implementation. So that's kind of a hint of multitasking improvements. The other multitasking improvement that was kind of mentioned is location apps, and they'll actually be able to run in the background as well. So that's things like exercise tracking or turn-by-turn navigation, and they will continue to run in the background. All of that hints at sort of changes to the multitasking, but Microsoft didn't really talk about those in any detail. But it does appear what they're doing is continuing what they did with Windows Phone 7.5, in that they will be creating APIs that allow certain types of multitasking to happen, you know, kind of an extension of the background agents and the background processes that already exist, and it'll be around specific use cases. I would hope that they also improve kind of the consumer facing bit, for example, the kind of the relaunching issue, i.e. you know, you can have an application already open, but if you press on the live tile or the app launcher, it will launch that application from fresh again rather than switching to the currently paused in the background version. So there's obviously a lot more to come there, but I think the hints of that are pretty promising. So yeah, watch this space. And if there's one thing I could say from all this, you know, we've talked now I think for an hour almost about all the various elements, but actually we're probably only just scratching the surface. It was kind of a platform preview, so there's lots more information to come. So keep listening to the podcast, and we'll keep you filled in as far as we can.
Rafe, you know what I think we should do here?
What's that, Ewan?
I think we should end on a dramatic cliffhanger as we reveal that David is actually a Cyberman and talk about the rest of the implications affecting hardware partners, Windows Phone 7.8, and the implications it has for this handset users, where Samsung are, HTC, the appearance of Hawaii. I think we should preview all of that, end on the cliffhanger, and come back with a part two and do two Insight podcasts this week.
Ooh, yes, that's a great idea, because we've been talking for so long, I would imagine people have fallen asleep listening to it. Well, I hope not, because it's a terribly exciting podcast, but yes, well, stay tuned for part two.
Charlie the cat is on my shoulders digging and closing, and she needs her lunchtime milk, so I really need to run and service the legions of the catdom. David?
You will be assimilated.
Ah, diddly-dum, 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 diddly-dum. We've lost the Americans now, haven't we, Ray? Diddly-dum.
Yeah, Ewan's trying to impersonate Doctor Who music, and I always thought assimilated was the Borg rather than the Daleks or the Cybermen.
Oh, but no, anyway. Tenth Planet, Part 2, 1969.
Okay, Ewan's other secret interest apart from Eurovision is Doctor Who trivia, in case anyone didn't notice. But yeah, thanks for listening, everybody, to this podcast. No, Ewan, we need to wrap things up. So it's okay, goodbye from me, Ralph Blanford.
And goodbye from me, Ronnie Corbett.
And bye for now from me, David Gilson.